Today's Teisha will be on case 14 in the Mumonkan, the Gate of No Barrier. Nansen cuts the cat in two. Nansen Osho saw monks of the Eastern and Western halls quarreling over a cat. He held up the cat and said, "If you can give an answer, you will save the cat. If not, I will kill it." No one could answer, and Nansen cut the cat in two. That evening, Joshu returned, and Nansen told him of the incident. Joshu took off his sandal, placed it on his head, and walked out. "If you had been there," Nansen remarked, "you would have saved the cat." Mumon's comment: "Tell me, what did Joshu mean when he put the sandal on his head? If you can give a turning word on this, you will see that Nansen's decree, was carried out with good reason. If not, danger." Mumon's verse: "Had Joshu been there, he would have done the opposite. When the sword is snatched away, even Nansen begs for his life." I want to talk about the one particular aspect of this koan today. Some koans have more than one aspect. And in this case, there's several parts or aspects to the koan. The first part involves Nansen's cutting the cat in two. And the second part is the action of Joshu, his student, putting the sandals on his head. I'm particularly interested in the second part of the koan today. Some of you are currently involved in working with the Mu Koan. And if you're starting to work with the Mu Koan, the name of the game is moving beyond your thoughts. So people who are working on the Mu Koan at first are trying to get to a place where thoughts disappear. And this is not easy to do. Yeah. You know, you sit on the cushion, and if you've been working with your breath, you can begin to enter a kind of a samadhi state. If you're watching your breath, you can enter a state where you feel more connected to things around you, where thoughts are less prevalent, and you can feel very good in that samadhi state. And then a teacher will give you the Mu Koan, generally speaking. And then you sit on the cushion and you work with your breath for a while. And after you're stabilized and calm, you call. With each out-breath. And you do this until something happens. Now, the truth is that people have often misunderstood the Mu Koan. People think there might be something magical in the word Mu, like Om, but that's not so. The word Mu means nothingness or emptiness. And the function of the Mu Koan is to take you to nothingness or emptiness. So if you're just sitting on the cushion and you're just with every out-breath you're going Mu, 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 this is an exercise in futility. And you may never have anything develop if that's the way you're practicing. So when people are given the Mu Koan, in traditional settings, they're not told how to use this particular door. But let me give you a secret. Give away a secret. You know, when you're sitting on the cushion and you're calling Mu, it would be a good idea if periodically you looked at your own mind. And by this I mean that it's possible to look in your mind or look with your, we say in English, your mind's eye. Your mind's eye. You know, if you close your eyes right now, you might be able to visualize, the British Virgin Islands, if you've been there, or Hawaii, or your house, or your mother. There's your mother. You can see her in your mind. She's waving to you. She has, you know, your lunch in her hand or something. You know. So we have this capacity to look in the mind and see, like watching television. In fact, you know, TV is really an invention that externalized or made a machine out of something that we already had, which is the screen in our heads. So TV really isn't such a new invention. It's just a machine that does what our minds could already do. So we have, like, in our heads a screen, and you can look in there and see. We do this commonly, right? When you're at the end of a day of sitting, for example, as you lie in bed, things may go by the screen, you know, just images, ideas, thoughts. So one way to practice Mu is to just sit there and go Mu, 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 Mu. But what you really should be doing is using Mu to reach to turn off the screen, so to speak, or to blank, to get to the screen, to the blank dark screen. The way to do this is to call Mu, and periodically, not every time, but every once in a while, look in at your own mind, at the screen in your mind. Some people visualize it, I guess, outside of their heads. It's interesting. I was doing Dokusan with somebody, and I kept saying, it's like the screen in your head. And this person said, it's not in my head, it's in front of me. I said, really? Okay. So I guess different people experience it differently. But I experience it like a screen in my head. Maybe you experience it as a screen outside your head. But look at that screen. That's what we call in English your mind's eye. Look with your mind's eye at your mind. Okay, so look with what we call your mind's eye at your mind. And looking at your mind is like looking at this screen in your head. And when you go at the end of your breath, maybe if you do that 3 or 4 times, and you look at the screen should be blank. Or dark. When you look, there's just nothing there. See? And this is a very important state to achieve. See? This means that the mental obstacles are temporarily gone, and you're going to come alive in a much more dramatic way than you normally can, because we have all of these mental obstacles that block life energy as it flows through our bodies. So, try this. I recommend this to everybody, you might give it a try. And when you call Mu 3 or 4 times, you can look in your mind and see if the screen is blank. And if it's full of images, then you know it's not blank yet. You go back to the breath and try to sweep these images or sweep clean the screen. Little by little, you will eventually be able to get to a point where when you look at the screen, it's blank and dark, and then you want to just keep going back there. This is the essence of Mu practice. Okay? So the function of the Mu koan is to take you to the blank, dark screen initially. Now, you know, what can happen to people is complicated in real practice. There's theory and there's practice, right? I'm teaching a course right now, a special course at Rutgers, and it's called The Buddhist Path. And a number of students, are about 21 students, are taking that course. And it's an interesting course. But I have to tell you that what we're doing is much more important than any course. This is that's the theory. This is the reality. But in the course, we have been looking at some early meditation techniques, and we've also been looking at some early sutras. And I mentioned in class the other day that in one of his sutras, the Buddha said that I think it will take most people about 7 years to achieve enlightenment. And I don't remember, but I think I told the class that's 7 years, 2,000 years ago, before TV, before many of the distractions in our life now. So Buddha had a kind of optimistic view at the time. It sometimes takes a little more than 7 years. It took me more than 7 years. So, at any rate, why is it the case that people didn't just hear the Buddha and have Daikensho immediately? See, this is interesting to me. Actually, there were people who actually had that experience in the Buddha's time. There were people like Maha Kashyapa, Great Kashyapa, who actually just heard the Buddha's teaching and instantly had enlightenment. That's amazing, isn't it? But this is what happened. Shariputra, a number of the Buddha's advanced students, met him, heard his teaching, and had Daikensho right on the spot. Right? That's amazing. Why doesn't that happen to everybody? Why is it the case that, you know, when the Buddha went around teaching, he didn't just say, this is it, dot, 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 and then everybody would just, bing, enlightened. Right? Be great, wouldn't it? It would be great if people could just come to Sesshin, and day one, day two, day three, day four, day five, Kensho. Right? And maybe if it's a 7-day Sesshin, day six and day seven, enjoying Kensho. Yeah, be great. You know, I got a call from a reporter from the Star Ledger asking me about the Dalai Lama. And he asked me a number of questions, and he asked about meditation. And I said, well, meditation is challenging. I said, 35,000 people are going to go see the Dalai Lama, but probably 35,000 people are not going to meditate. And he didn't know what I was talking about. But probably, if I could guarantee, if you could guarantee Kensho at just one session, Kensho guaranteed, you would get more than, you know, you might get 35,000 people. You know, people would give it a try. But the truth is, you know, generally doesn't happen. Maha Kashyapa was an extraordinary person. Shariputra, these were extraordinary people. Generally speaking, on hearing the Buddha's teaching, it requires from us some substantial effort. And when we come to Sesshin, it turns out that Daikensho doesn't present itself necessarily in 5 days. And that's interesting, I think. You know, what happens to people on day two of a Sesshin is quite important. On day one of Sesshin, people come often with a kind of resolution or determination. And they chose to come here. They made a resolution, made a kind of vow. And it's thrilling to see people start the Sesshin with that kind of determination. Practice, practice, you know, focus, focus. And sometimes it's the case that by the end of the first day, the person's really in the groove, really in the group. And it's so often the case that on day two of the session, and sometimes it's day three, that it's like somebody pulled the rug out from under you, right? I don't know if you've had this experience, but it's like getting ready for a race. You've been training every week. You come to the race, you know, you do the first lap, and you're ahead of everybody. And then the next, you go to the next lap, and it's like, all of a sudden, you fall apart, right? And it's like, God damn it. You know, I came here with such high expectations and such determination. And now my sitting stinks. You know, my mind's all over the place. You know, this is so unfair. But this is quite typical. This is almost guaranteed, as a matter of fact. Because we're not, unfortunately, Mahakashapa or Shariputra. Generally speaking, we have acquired a great deal of karmic baggage, a great deal of karmic baggage. And so, you know, we hear the Buddha's teaching, but we don't have the Daikensho on the spot. And we come to Sesshin, but unfortunately, it's not a straight line from point A to point B, because of our karma, because of things we've done. Now, you know, it might, you know, maybe you're young, and you say, well, I haven't done anything particularly terrible, you know, yet. Well, you know, I haven't killed anybody in this life, but I have actually wanted to, let me tell you. So, you know, I must say that I have created a fair number of negative obstacles for myself in my life. And so I had to work very hard in Zen practice to overcome the obstacles that I created for myself. And when we come to Sesshin and we begin to practice, we have high hopes and great expectations, and determination, and a good heart. And we set off on the race, and then what can happen is that on day two, it's like, bam, you know, everything goes to pieces. And the mind won't stay focused, and all of this junk is coming up, and suddenly we have anger, disappointment, you know, self-loathing, you name it. You think, where did this come from? But this is the essence of Sesshin, right? I mean, one way to think about Sesshin is this is like karmic hospital. This is like where we go to repair ourselves, having screwed ourselves up. You know, we believe the teaching, probably, or we wouldn't be here. But, you know, it's not a straight shot, because you sit on the cushion, and you call Mu, and you look at the blank screen, and it maybe for a while it's blank. And then all of a sudden, instead of having a blank screen, all this junk starts coming up and cluttering up your screen again. And it's like back to square one. You have to realize that this is your karma. Like, this is karma. This is what we came here to clean up. Now, this is the hard work of Sesshin. When we're in this state, you know, it's like looking at ourselves, at our small self, in a mirror. You know, we all have an exalted image of ourselves and an exalted image of how things should work out for us. You know, so we come, you know, I remember, I swear that I actually said this, in when I was in college, I read a bunch of books on Zen in college. And I remember talking to a friend of mine, Tom Steptoe, and I was reading these books on Zen. And he said something like, do you think you could wake up, you could achieve enlightenment? I said, oh yeah, I'm sure. You know, I said, you know, if I just went away for 5 days, I'll bet I could do it. I swear to you, I said that. You know? And then I forgot all about Zen for a while, and then I ran into Genki Roshi. And I was thinking about this, my saying that. Tom's dad had a log cabin up in the mountains outside of his home in West Virginia. And we would leave our college and go up there and study when we had to do like exams. We'd just go up there and just cram for exams and drive back. And I brought some of my Zen books, and I actually said to Tom, yeah, I think I could do it. I just sat down, you know, like for 4 or 5 days, I could do it. And, you know, when I went to my first sesshin, it was quite a shocker because, you know, I was just in so much physical pain. Any thought of enlightenment was far from my horizon. But as I progressed in my practice, you know, I began to, it took me a long time, but I began to see myself as I really was, you know. And it wasn't the way I had imagined myself. You know, so, you know, one day you do enough meditation, one day what happens to you is you're on your job or you're in home, and you suddenly see this anger rise up inside of you, you know, and you think, where did that come from? You know? This is a wonderful moment because you're beginning to see who you really are. And or you see your fear, or you see yourself taking advantage of somebody else, you know. And you know, day two of sesshin is often like this. It's like suddenly we come up against a wall, and that wall is our karma. That's our small self. You know, it would be nice to sit on the cushion, enter mu, have a breakthrough, on to Daikensho, but along the way something happens, and that something is all the little choices and decisions we've made in our lives, and those are the things that stop us from being with mu from moment to moment, you know, hour after hour. Now, you know, it's really important not to beat yourself up about this. You know, actually you shouldn't hate yourself even for a split second. Ever. That's not the teaching of the Buddha. Nothing you have done is irredeemably bad or terrible, or anything of the kind. In fact, you know, even if you had killed somebody, it would not be irredeemably bad. What you would have to do is just what you're doing, sitting down on the cushion and working through your karma. You know, from the Buddha's perspective, nobody can do this work for you. You have to do it yourself. It's like you made the mess, you have to clean it up. And that's fair, isn't it? You know. So we sit on the cushion, and we have our mental habits, whatever they are, and we have to clean them up. And little by little, you know, mind becomes blank and dark. And this is a great victory. You know, and it's going to take a while for most of us. And day two is usually the day that most people like the least, you know. Last sesshin, we had a sesshin in August, and I believe there was a person who actually drove away on day two. They went into Dokusan, and then the next thing I knew, I saw the car driving by the windows here. And what I would say is, this is somebody who just didn't want to face, look in the mirror and see. And it's not my job to tell you what you see in the mirror. Most people see it for themselves. And in fact, I make a point of never talking about what might be in the mirror, because I can't see it. Only you can see it. But when you see it, you know, don't beat yourself up. Just realize, okay, I'm going to clean it up. You know, no matter how bad it is, no matter how deep the karma might seem, you know, it's not irredeemably bad. So just start shoveling, you know, one breath at a time. You're cleaning up a little karma, little karma, little karma. Wonderful, you know. You'll have these moments where suddenly, you know, you are facing the blank screen. and the beautiful life energy is flowing through your body. And the next day you get up and what do you know? It's gone again. So start shoveling. You know, this is the path. For ordinary people like ourselves, this is how it is. But it's really wonderful. I mean, this is such a wonderful opportunity to purify body, heart, and mind. And it's really like magic, you know, because honestly, anything you have done can be purified in this way. You know, when people do this kind of thing, they do have changes of heart. You know, I once had a person who came in to see me and he was crying because when he was younger, he used to beat his dog and kick his dog and things like that. And he was so remorseful. That's such a good thing, right? It's such a good thing. And I've had people who, you know, come in and say, I've got to call my wife and tell her I love her, or I have to call my mother when this is over. And this is beautiful. This is wonderful. So, you know, Mahakashapa heard the teaching and instantly awoke. For most of us, it's a little more complicated journey. Now, once you can reach a dark mind, once you can reach that dark blank place, it's really wonderful to stay there. It's a beautiful place. In fact, you know, that mind is so purifying and so wonderful. When you go into deep mushing, it's wonderful. And when you come out of it, everything is so fresh and clear. I guess you saw the moon last night. You know, after doing zazen all day, your legs probably hurt, but you walk outside and you look up at that moon and those stars, and it's like your eyes and your ears and your mind have been washed clean, and it's just all so fresh. You know, all the images, everything that you behold is so alive, right? This morning, just a little while ago, people were standing out looking at the wind blowing in the trees. It's just like everything is cleansed and fresh. You know, so this state of blankness or darkness is really precious, you know, hard to win, hard to achieve, and then very precious. But there's a danger in residing there in the wrong way, believe it or not. You know, people who can enter deep samadhi, deep mushin, can get trapped there. That's very interesting and very important to know. You know, the Buddha studied with a man named, Kalama, Alara Kalama. Alara Kalama was a great rishi, and he taught mushin. And the Buddha studied with him and mastered the deep mushin. He could enter that blank, dark state, and his body became like a hollow reed. Yeah? And Alara Kalama said to him, Siddhartha Gautama, you have achieved this state of enlightenment, and I would like you to be my student, and I'd like you to teach with me. And the Buddha said, actually, I don't think this is enlightenment. It's a wonderful state, but it's not complete awakening. And he left Alara Kalama and went to study with a man whose name was, another teacher. It's interesting that the Buddha turned away from this teaching and said, not complete. You know, when you can enter deep mushin, if you stay in that state in a superficial way, it's beautiful and wonderful, but it's not enlightenment, and you can become trapped there. This could be, there's a Zen teacher who has called this the cave of poison grass, because it's like the grass is so sweet, you know, and so beautiful, you want to just stay in the cave. And so, beware of just lingering in that state. What has to happen is you have to go deeper, and something has to happen that will change the character of your experience of this condition. That was kind of abstract, sorry. The calm, blank mind is not the deepest mind. And when you are at a deeper state, there's a deeper coming to life of your whole being. And in Zen practice, we have two sides to the koan of mu. First side is entering darkness or blankness. The second side is going deeper into it and having the experience of coming back to life or coming to life in this state. The way we help people do this is by asking them to call mu. See, to actually call mu. So people come into the Dokusan room and I'll say, what's your koan? I'll say, my koan is mu, and I'll say, please call mu. And they'll say, mu, or mu, or mu. And it seems so contrived. It's like, what could be sillier than this, right? What could be more less spontaneous and more contrived, see? Now, in this story of Nansen killing the cat, we have a what you might call an ethical dilemma. See, ethical dilemma. You have a great Zen teacher, Nansen, who comes into the Dokusan room. This is like the Dalai Lama coming into the Dokusan room, right? A great apostle, or Ali in Islam, be like Apostle Peter, or Ali in Islam, or Krishna, somebody who's loaded with, this is the man, this is the person who embodies the sacred. Nansen comes in, and he holds up an innocent cat, and he says, unless somebody here can show me enlightened mind, I will kill this cat. See, now all of the people sitting in the temple are in deep mushin. All of them are sitting in blank darkness, but they haven't gone deep enough. See, they're just lingering in that blank darkness. And so none of them are able to act spontaneously at that moment. And Nansen kills the cat, he cuts it in two. So this is like a failure. This is like Zen failure. This is like a failure of Zen practice. Because at a crucial moment when these people had to make a life and death ethical decision, see, they cracked out. They were lingering in a beautiful, peaceful stillness and blankness. And they were unable to act spontaneously. See, now later in the story, Joshua comes back. And as soon as he hears the story, he acts with complete spontaneity. He doesn't calculate. He's in deep mushin, but he acts spontaneously. And he puts his sandals on his head, and he walks out the door. Now, to the discriminating mind, this is meaningless action. But in the deeper condition of awakened perception, this is like a very important action. This is the correct action. So Joshua is not stumped by this ethical dilemma. He knows he shouldn't try to reason it out. You know, he knows that discriminating intellect isn't adequate. But he also knows that just dwelling in blankness and darkness is also not adequate. There needs to be spontaneous action. We call this Zen spontaneity. And calling Mu is the way to cultivate Zen spontaneity. Now you could say, but there's nothing spontaneous about going into the room and calling Mu. You expect me to call Mu, and I'll call Mu. And I know I have to do it, so I'm sitting there on the cushion for an hour before Dokusan thinking, oh, I've got to call Mu. But what happens in this process is the same thing that happens in the second day of Sesshin. You start out thinking you control the situation, and you can control the outcome. But then you lose control, and you start drifting. You know, and you can get frustrated, angry, fearful, etc. But at some point, it's like a higher energy takes over, right? You connect with the universe. See, you'll never solve the Mu Koan until you actually just give up and call Mu. So, I'll tell you the answer to the Mu Koan. Sit on the cushion, face the blankness, come into the Dokusan room and call Mu. And at that point, it's out of your hands. See, you think you can control it, but you can't. You might want to say, okay, I'll blow him away. I'll give him a powerful Mu. You know, it may or may not come out as a powerful Mu, but the fact that it's contrived will be obvious to both of us. You know, there's a moment when somebody comes in and he just calls Mu with his whole being, and the outcome is utterly up to the universe. See? It's utterly up to the universe how it's going to turn out. And this is at this moment you have harmonized yourself with the universe. Then it's not your voice, it's the voice of the universe that I hear. And we don't know when we're going to hear that voice. You just have to make yourself available. It's like Sesshin itself. You don't know when your karma is going to be cleaned up and you're going to enter a state of blankness and a beautiful energy flowing through your body. You just have to make yourself available. And we come to Sesshin thinking we can control it. But by day two or day three, we realize it's out of our power to control. We need to call on the universe, or we need to unify ourselves with the larger life of everything around us. And we do this by emptying ourselves out and waiting patiently. You know, in the Mu Koan, in the case of the Mu Koan, we do this by calling Mu, even though we know it's hopeless. It's like waiting for the Lotto to come in, right? You know, you come into the Dokusan room, you call Mu, Mu. Lifeless. Then you try to make it better, but it's still it's contrived. Then you're back to lifeless. You just keep calling. One day, lightning strikes. It's like this happens to everybody who does anything that they really care about, you know? You can practice hitting a baseball for hours on end. One day you go to the plate and you send it into the bleachers. And if somebody said, how did you make that happen? You have to say, I don't know. You know, but you made yourself available and the universe moved the ball. See, there's nothing mysterious. It's not about, it's nothing mysterious about this, you know. If you're a great artist, you paint a lot of paintings here in your life, but one of them turns out to be your masterpiece, right? You know, and it somehow all comes together beyond your control. So this takes great trust in life, great trust in the universe. And it's hard for us to sometimes get in touch with that trust. You know, but calling Mu is a foolish action, right? It's silly, really. You go in and Mu. It's foolish and silly and, you know, humiliating almost, right? But every time you do it, you know, you're opening yourself up to failure and you're expressing your trust in life. This is so important, right? Coming to Sesshin is just like this. You know, when you come to, a lot of people don't come to Sesshin, they read books on Buddhism. But they don't come to Sesshin because they want to hold on to Buddhism as a kind of reassuring mythos. Right? They want to say to their friends, well, I think I could wake up in about 5 days if I really put my mind to it. So you've come here because you trust life enough to come. And on day two of the Sesshin, things don't go your way, yeah? It's like getting a pie in the face. But, you know, basically, you made the pie, you know? And, you know, this is a beautiful opportunity to find a deeper way to live. You know, beautiful opportunity to find a way to live that isn't fearful, anxious, selfish, and so on and so on. So, you know, calling Wu is really a wonderful practice. You know, please don't dismiss it out of hand as silly or trivial. You're giving the universe an opportunity to move through your body. Yeah? You're letting the universe in. And of course, each time you try it, when you try it, it's not always going to work. The universe isn't always going to come. But when it comes, you'll know it. It'll be wonderful. This is how Joshu lived his life, see? You know, Joshu lived his life every minute with this kind of openness. You know, we can all do it. We don't all, maybe we're not all Joshus, but we can all live with that openness. Nansen Osho saw monks of the Eastern and Western halls quarreling over a cat. He held up the cat and he said, if you can give an answer, if you can show me enlightenment, you will save the cat. If not, I will kill it. No one could act. And Nansen cut the cat in two. No one could stir themselves from their blank mind. That evening, Joshu returned, and Nansen told him of the incident. Joshu took off his sandal, placed it on his head, and walked out. If you had been there, Nansen remarked, you could have saved the cat's life, could have saved a life, if you could have acted from pure spontaneity. Mumon's comment. Tell me, what did Joshu mean when he put the sandal on his head? If you can give a turning word on this, you will see that Nansen's decree was carried out with good reason. If not, danger. Mumon's verse, had Joshu been there, he would have done the opposite. When the sword is snatched away, even Nansen begs for his life. He would have, instead of taking life, he would have brought life. Would have given life instead of taking life. So this is day two of our Sesshin. Some of you have very busy schedules and are not able to stay for the full 5 days. And I want to tell you how grateful I am that you've come here and how much I appreciate your determination. And you've made a place for this in your schedules, and I know how busy you are, and I think it's wonderful you've come here. And so others are here for 5 days, and we have ahead of us a beautiful opportunity to live in this way, this life of trust, one with the trusting mind, right? One with the trusting mind. So it's not so bad to be foolish, to do something that makes one look foolish. I do it all the time, you know. And the important thing is to be living, in a way that it's really alive, really makes you feel alive, really makes you feel joy. no matter how you seem.